Welcome to the Retail Focus Podcast, a weekly collection of news, interviews, and information from the world of retail.
Welcome to this edition of the Retail Focus Podcast. I'm Trent Kling, and Leighton joining us for today's episode, making time in his busy schedule to talk some retail this week. Coming up on today's show, we'll each talk about recent retail visits we've made throughout the country. We'll discuss CBRE and their formation of kind of a new task force for malls, if you will. We'll talk about retail hiring, and in news, we'll talk about JCPenney's turnaround strategy and an update from Simon. A reminder that you can like us or rate us on any podcast listening service, and those likes and ratings help others to find us. So if you enjoy the podcast, those certainly help others to search us out and similarly, hopefully, enjoy us at least. You can also check us out on social media at Retail Podcast on both Twitter and Instagram. Coming up this week, we'll be sharing some grocery pictures from Montana, a very fractured grocery market, which is something we'll talk about later on in the show. But first, we start with JCPenney and Leighton. We received an update on their turnaround strategy and status this week as a result of Simon's latest earnings call. This would be Simon Property Group, one half now of the ownership group of JCPenney, along with Brookfield Property Partners.
The call provided an unusual amount of color for JCPenney specifically. The main aspect of the news, at least to us, was the liquidity of the company. According to David Simon, JCPenney has $1.2 billion in cash and credit availability, which is notable as this is something that they were beginning to lack pre-bankruptcy. Still, they are not taking any chances, noting that they're in capital preservation mode, which is probably the best thing for them at the moment. JCPenney, like so many other struggling retailers before them, tried throwing a lot of spaghetti at the wall. When things don't stick, like appliances, for example, that we had taken pictures of and posted on our social media, it creates a massive dent in cash reserves for multiple reasons. Another item that was really brought up during the call was their vendor relationships, specifically repairing the relationships after the bankruptcy process. We've seen in the cases of previously bankrupt department stores, such as Sears and Montgomery Ward, for instance, when the vendor relationships erode, it creates a harsh downward spiral. Simon, as a company, said that there's still a lot of work to be done on this front in particular, but things are trending in a positive direction. It doesn't appear that JCPenney was actually having issues pre-bankruptcy with vendors, but of course, there were settlements as a part of the bankruptcy plan, so a lot of goings-on behind the scenes there. Therefore, it was more vendors being unwilling to ship product before payment, which was creating some cash flow issues. However, they noted that this appears to be turning around somewhat, and vendors have really built confidence that Simon and Brookfield have an actual plan in place. In fact, JCPenney has been able to add brands to its portfolio with increased vendor partnerships as of late.
And you know, vendors, something we talk about a lot in terms of retailers that are struggling financially, retailers that are going bankrupt. You look, and it's not just JCPenney. That was an issue with Toys R Us, pre-bankruptcy for them. It was an issue even going back to the early 90s with Children's Palace. Their vendor relationships fell through right before Christmas. That left shelves empty, that left revenues down, and that leads to that harsh spiral you were talking about. So JCPenney, really their main fight here is to restore their relationships with vendors so that they don't have the empty shelves, so that when people go through the doors at JCPenney, now that the pandemic is apparently easing up, CDC just issued guidance for those with the vaccine that they can go in public without masks. You might see more people going through those doors at JCPenney. JCPenney wants to be sure those shelves are full. And regarding those sales from people coming through the doors and people ordering online, Simon said that they've been up year over year since exiting bankruptcy in December. Now, this is a good sign as far as January and February are concerned, but we would be shocked if year-over-year sales weren't up in March and April. Of course, they are lapping the pandemic sales months, so you're likely to see probably high double-figure sales jumps there, and I would imagine the 50 to 60% range, at least that's what's been bandied about by some other apparel retailers. Overall, though, David Simon said on this call, the plan is actually ahead of schedule at this point. Things are looking good, and they're looking at potentially leveraging partnerships with other recently acquired brands as well. Of course, Simon and Brookfield have their hands in a number of other brands. Simon particularly with Forever 21, and they're not ruling out the fact that there might be some partnerships either with clothing brands, specialty branded merchandise, or maybe some other things coming down the pike. But still, it was refreshing to see this. Some good news by way of JCPenney, a company that hasn't seen a lot of great news over the past few years. Well, coming up after this break, after our short news segment there, we'll talk to Mike Welsh. Mike Welsh with Mobiquity. He's been on the podcast before, but he's going to join us to update us on really where things are at in terms of building apps that interact with loyalty programs, particularly in the convenience store space. More importantly, though, he's going to talk about how this has impacted the brick and mortar setting for these convenience stores and how they've had to rethink some of their designs as well as a result of the success of some of these apps. Seemingly every earnings call or every time a retail executive speaks about their company, we hear loyalty brought up, usually in the context, of course, of a loyalty program. And last year on the show, we discussed the developments in loyalty as it pertains to the C-store space, but a lot has happened as it pertains to loyalty programs and convenience stores in the intervening time. And to that end, we're pleased to be joined by Mike Welsh, the Chief Creative Officer at Mobiquity, to discuss how some C-stores drive loyalty through tying apps in with their existing loyalty programs. Mobiquity, by the way, they count among their clients Come & Go and Wawa, two thriving and absolutely major C-store players, one, of course, in the Midwest and one on the East Coast. Mike, welcome back to the podcast.
Hey, thanks for having me. Glad to be here.
First, just as we did back when we last talked, and just in case our listeners didn't catch that episode so that they know the perspective that you bring, I was wondering if you could talk a little bit about Mobiquity and then what Mobiquity does on the day-to-day.
Sure. Happy to. So Mobiquity is an 11-year-old mobile app development professional services company. And so what we do for clients like Wawa and K&G is help them get to market with, you know, five-star experiences that can be compelling and drive business and value for their companies and their customers.
When you look at a bigger term picture, it seems like advancements in app-based and mobile loyalty program tie-ins with C-stores have just been constant. What's new? What are some of the newer things we've seen over the last 9 months or so in particular?
So a couple of things have been happening. So COVID, obviously, for every podcast that you do in the last year, sort of highlights some of the new structural changes, whether it's use of QR codes inside the applications, QR codes in the parking lots. A lot of our clients have gone to curbside takeaway, right? You have the 3PL providers, DoorDash, Uber Eats. But now you've got the application themselves, the Wawa's and K&G's of the world, that want to own that equity, that brand equity that comes with shopping at one of those C stores or QSRs, as sometimes they're referred to. And so what you see new is all the parking lots have numbers. Every parking spot at a Wawa has a number painted on it now. Not just like the three spots that used to be outside the Outback where you'd pick up your curbside. Any side is sort of the new norm for a lot of these operators. The other piece is the operations themselves have changed so that when you walk in, there used to be a counter and a cash wrap. Now there's a counter, cash wrap, and a pickup location for the DoorDashers and the Uber Eats guys. The other piece of it is now with mobile ordering, they've sort of built in things like radar.io, for example, which is allowing them to see users approach the store and then do a little bit more air traffic control and operations management on what's coming next. So they got a little bit of an air traffic control feel in the application as you approach the store. So you're starting to see these platforms turn into more operating systems for those businesses. One of the short sights of a lot of these companies that I see is that they are so fixated on that average order value and the money they make now with the customers they know now, they forget that there is a whole group of customers that you could have. And I think COVID opened a lot of companies' eyes. What COVID forced them to do was to take the risk. So we've seen some of our clients come to us with these platforms and say, well, now I've got this mature mobile platform. How can I then turn that back to the other parts of the business? How do I reinvent the kiosk? How do I rethink the way the consumer wants to use the store? And so, you know, you think about the likes of Just Walk Out technology that Amazon's got. Tesco's been around forever. And so the idea that people will use QR codes and scans and scan and go and having much less contact, much less interaction in the spaces has made these applications much more remote control oriented about how you'll use a C-store.
I'm curious because you mentioned something, especially with the painted numbers on the parking spaces at a Wawa there. Obviously, anytime you're engaging with a mobile app, you're building out the mobile app, you're building out the loyalty program, it's got very real brick and mortar consequences, real estate based consequences as well. What's the dialogue like as you work with companies to try and figure out not only additional things to build in through the loyalty program via the app, but also how that's going to interact with that in-store experience as well?
Yeah, that's a good point. The thing that companies struggle with, the dialogue, as you mentioned, is about how do you protect, you know, if COVID happens, 40% of your foot traffic drops at your location. That doesn't mean people want less. It means that they'll switch over to a digital model and curbside or takeaway. And they'll do that with the idea that they'll have their average order value go up because you're getting more things on a less frequent basis, for example. Or you're still fueling, so they want pump activation, but I want loyalty payback for that. But I have to make sure the operation doesn't get overwhelmed by all the curbsides happening and no one's refreshing the forecourt. You know, the towels, the little gloves they put on so you can touch the pump. So what operators are starting to do is figure out, how do I manage forecourt, backcourt? How do I do it operationally so I can still maintain profitability? I can still maintain the operator's discipline around replenishment, inventory, supply chain, but still give the customer as much control as we could possibly give them over the kind of experience that they want, you know, from a convenience store transaction, which back in the day was 90 seconds. Now it might be a few minutes because you're going to go in, you got to put your mask on, you got to walk in the store. There's 6-foot separation, so maybe you have to wait outside for a minute or two in the morning. So those kinds of things, operators are trying to ease the burden and sort of increase the convenience, which is sort of their raison d'etre.
Of course, we talk about convenience, also safety, another major factor in terms of building out these loyalty programs. In terms of both convenience and safety, what are some things that you've at least heard from these operators as things that they're trying to keep in mind when they're engaging people through their loyalty platforms?
Yeah, a lot of times it's simple messaging, right? It starts with, how does the app respond, you know, when you open it? Does it give you the mask mandate? Does it give you the sort of COVID updates? So embedding that information into these experiences is really important. The associates know when you come in, everybody's been told you have to wear a mask. Everybody knows that that's our policy. The other piece is making sure that all the sanitizing stations and all those kinds of things are all replenished. That's sort of a ground wire for a lot of places where you walk up and the battery's dead. And that happens in lots of different businesses. As I talk to clients and our teams work with clients on loyalty is, how can I reward some behavior? How can I incent some behavior? Actual real behavior in an operation, you could actually incentivize behavior to maintain safety. So you can limit quantities of people coming. You can give, you know, per cents off, you know, per gallon, per liter at the pump, and then give a surprise and delight where an associate might walk out with a cup of coffee that you ordered yesterday, said, hey, I thought maybe you want another cup of coffee. There's a lot of ways that these businesses are now trying to sort of embed the safety piece, encourage the loyalty participation and incentivize behavior, and also protect their associates. You know, Wawa's got 18 to 20,000 associates. They want to make sure that they all stay safe and healthy. So there's a lot of initiatives that these companies have undertaken to sort of make sure that they embed that messaging, embed that communication, and make everybody sort of on the same page from a operating a C-store location.
Now, of course, Mobiquity does a lot of work in terms of C-store loyalty programs, and that's kind of the headline of what we're talking about here. But of course, Mobiquity helps with a number of other applications across the board, across the entire world of business as well. What are some things that Mobiquity has gleaned maybe from operations in the convenience store industry that you've been able to use in terms of developments in other areas that you serve?
Yeah, this is a good question. And there is a lot of sort of cross-industry experience because convenience is something everybody wants in almost every interaction, whether it's a convenience store or it's your healthcare or if it's, you know, a telecommunications company that's trying to do top-ups of your LTE so you can have a weekend of Instagram when you go to a soccer game. So what we've learned in the convenience space is that people's attention is very, very small. Like it's a short fuse for a lot of people, especially after, you know, over a year of lockdowns, a year of mask mandates, a year of all this, making sure that we can translate some of the things that we learned in curbside, for example. If you've got another kind of business, the idea that you wouldn't just paint 3 spots, you'll paint all the spots and you'll make the forecourt, the gas pumps are also pickup locations. So what you try to do is keep the blinders wide as you can until you make decisions and you defer them as far as you can so you can get the most data out of the experience and then go in and say, all right, well, how's the human going to suffer by what we're making? And what can we do to make it less friction, more effortless, and anticipate. One of the biggest things that we've done in the last couple of years is focus on anticipating the user's context and then delivering messaging and meaningful content at that moment. And that's made a big difference from a loyalty standpoint. That thing's just going to shoot out coupons or barcodes. What if you can wrap an experience around that so that the loyalty fits a context that you anticipated? That is a meaningful sort of moment for a lot of consumers.
You bring up an interesting point, and I think it's something we don't talk enough about, but that's the attention span of the customer. Oftentimes, very, very quick, like you said, almost like a blink. What are some ways in which companies can engage customers but hold that attention span for just long enough, or conversely, make their applications such that they operate quick enough to be able to kind of satiate that attention span, if you will?
Yeah, for sure. I think, you know, people have goldfish attention spans, and you could train a model. So if you're using AWS or one of the cloud providers, you could train machine learning models with transactional data from that consumer and lookalikes of that consumer, and then teach an AI how to actually provide messaging and hold that attention. Again, a lot of these businesses are just attention merchants anyway. So the idea that they're trying to get you to a good or service or a product, the idea if you can anticipate context, you can have a product orientation about that. You can teach an AI and a machine to learn behavior. And I always talk about the concept of watching and acting. Most loyalty programs are acting and watching. You know, they send you a coupon and they watch for redemption. And they don't want over redemption, they just want regular redemption. The paradigm shifts now to a let's watch first behavior, transactional data. Let's train a model to then personalize that experience. And an AI can deliver at the moment it's needed, the most personalized, context relevant offer. And then the redemption events that occur, you can watch and then act and then see what's the right formula. The machine can learn it, takes all the transaction data, puts a consumer in a context. The minute that they leave the parking lot, for example, instead of sending a message the minute transaction's over, wait until they're about 5 minutes outside the rim of the store. And then let's send a thank you message. And the message can have one little thing in it that is a feedback mechanism. And for that, you'll get a reward later. So the idea that you can take these moments of attention that are fractured, they're all over the place, and they're doing, you know, five different things on their phone, their kids are in the back throwing Cheerios at their heads. If you can get into that one moment, hold it for a second, and then deliver something a little bit later, you really can breadcrumb them back over and over again.
So you've mentioned something over the last few minutes, really over the entire interview. There's one word, anticipation, that you've been talking a lot about. So in terms of anticipations, we've talked about the developments recently, the last 9 months, the last couple of years. Anticipating, looking forward, what do the next 9 months or couple of years hold for not only convenience store loyalty, but app-based loyalty platforms as a whole?
The thing that I think the future of the struggle for people that are using these loyalty experiences is having cross-brand currency, having cross-brand loyalty, so that, you know, as these companies acquire and merge and do these things, I don't want to lose all of my loyalty customers. And so I think what companies need to do, the bigger C-store operators, have to start to think about, they're a data services company that happens to do fuel and convenience. And I think the reality is these companies are becoming data services companies because they're tracking so much behavior, they're consuming so much transaction information that the data can start to answer business questions, which it's never done before. How will demand get captured? How will I get repeat visit? How does loyalty really anticipate? And I think to some extent, you know, the earn and burn loyalty programs of the past are starting to become monetarily wise data services engagements, because that's where they can harvest the most value from all that accumulated data and operator data. I think the idea of steering a wallet, think of, you know, conceptually, everybody's going to have Apple, Samsung Pay. They're going to have that sort of digital wallet. Digital wallet is a place where you'll put digital currency. And I think to some extent, what loyalty providers will start to understand is that their average order values will start to change because all the models got blown up by COVID. So they're all starting from a new spot. And so as users' expectations change and how they'll use convenience, the anticipation factor goes up exponentially. How do you anticipate what kind of currency they're going to come to you with? So companies that resist sort of having all the pays, meaning you want to pay with Venmo, you want to use Apple Pay, you want to use Samsung, Google Pay, you want to have all of those. But those are just the wallet components. You want to also have behind those the digital currency. So I'm not saying that someone's going to show up at a Wawa and fill their tank up with Dogecoin, but there is a future where that's going to occur. So know how people want, when you leave the house, you know how you're going to pay for things when you leave your house. grab your keys in your wallet, and you know. With digital currency, the impulse control goes down, and there's opportunities for businesses to capitalize on that, where people use convenience just to go grab, you know, it used to be called the Cokes and Smokes business. So the loss leaders that draw people in are starting to change. And so, and the way they pay and how they pay. So loyalty programs and platforms have to get really good at anticipation, training those models with transactional data around the segments they have, and you're trying to get to a segment of one that you can steer for incremental value. A lot of these businesses don't get that exactly, that focus on understanding the segment, anticipating behavior, watching and acting can translate into a huge bottom line impact. We've seen 4-digit percent growth in some of these spaces where, you know, the client's taken this on and said, we're doing this. Even though they were a fast follower, even though they were sort of a little bit sort of risk averse, these kinds of things are being forced on them because of COVID, because of having to bring the business back. The channel of the physical store became reduced and the digital channel took off. So now they're feature adding. Now they're sort of having to reinvent all these things in the context of digital. And that's where I think wallet digital currency starts to play a significant role.
I want to finish up just with this follow-up question, because you talk about flexibility as it pertains to payments, as it pertains to currency. That's something we've heard a lot about recently, of course, share of digital wallets going up overall. In talking to maybe not necessarily the retailers that you serve at Mobiquity, but in talking to people in this space, what are some reasons that you've seen that retailers are hesitant to move into that payment flexibility? Because on the surface, it seems like an absolute no-brainer.
Yeah. And it is for the consumer, but it isn't for the business. So the reality of these businesses is if in a C-store space, you're operating on a very thin margin for a lot of the goods that you sell. The things that you have high margin on are things that you want to maintain profitability with, are oftentimes low cost items. If a business is thinking about getting into this stuff, there's the gateway fees. You know, years ago, Walmart tried to disintermediate MasterCard and Visa by creating its own sort of currency. And it didn't work. And the reason it doesn't work is because those businesses have trust with the consumer and you don't. So the percent that you pay is for the trust that's given by having that MasterCard and Visa on your bank card. I think in the future, what has to happen is these businesses and their treasury departments have to figure out a risk model that makes sense for them from a profitability standpoint and a sort of business delivery standpoint. And then ultimately, they have to kind of fall over to the consumer and say, this is the offer and this is what we have. It's up to them to sort of adopt. And I think if you have the most offerings, because there's a lot of unbanked customers still, there's a lot of cash customers still. And so bringing those people into a digital wallet, digital currency space is going to require the treasury departments and the finance departments in these companies to start to understand how the risk profile works for them. And I think that's a bigger question for those kinds of companies that have treasury and risk departments that are always looking to sort of unburden themselves of that risk and sort of putting that back on the consumer a little bit with fewer choices, fewer openings.
Great insight, some fantastic points there. Once again, Mike, we appreciate you taking the time to join us today.
No, thanks for having me. This was great. I appreciate it.
As always, we may have a position in or against companies we discuss on the podcast. Do not invest in stocks solely on the input of the podcast hosts.
We thank Mike for joining us. It's always a good time to have him on the show. You know, when he talked to us, we recorded the interview about a week ago. He was in Bismarck, North Dakota, a place I was in just about a year ago. I told him, hey, you got to stop by the Bisman Food Co-op, another interview we've had on the show with T. Jacob Schmoody, their produce director. And he said he mostly has enjoyed Bismarck by the time I talked to him, but he's on a cross-country tour, so hopefully he's made it back to the East Coast safe and sound, visited a ton of national parks, in fact, on his cross-country tour, something I'm hoping to do a little bit of here in the next couple of years. Now, Leighton, one of the things we like talking about on the show is our visits to retailers throughout the country. And you and I do a fair amount of traveling, whether that's for business or leisure, not unlike Mike Welsh of Mobiquity. And I was just curious, you know, we've got you on the show here. It's a good opportunity for us to talk about our retail experiences over the last couple of months in different areas of the country. What retail experiences do you bring to bear here today?
I've really stayed put, Trent, so thanks for asking. But not a lot of new retailers that I've visited here lately, but I have been doing my stops, my normal grocery stops at Costco, Albertsons, Kroger stores, which would be Ralph's and King Soopers, in fact. Not a lot to see other than, you know, traffic levels anecdotally, at least, again, this is from my personal experience over the last couple of months since I've been on the podcast. I feel as though traffic levels are rather robust. Costco, of course, we see same-store sales benefits coming in for the last 15 months, in fact, due to high traffic levels, thanks to the pandemic, a lot of people panic buying, but also, you know, stocking up on their normal groceries. And I feel as though all of these grocery chains have really benefited from the increased traffic levels, a lot of people still needing to buy food, not wanting really to go out to eat. A lot of people are, in fact, still trying to maybe cook more. So I think that's a good thing. So I think that that is going to be really strong if you are, let's say, a REIT that owns these grocery anchored shopping centers around the country. We talk about real estate on this podcast, but honestly, I think this is really a good, strong sign for those who love physical retail. I think physical retail will always need to have some sort of a presence. And I think, again, based on what I've seen with my own eyes, I think traffic levels are really strong. And I think people just want to get out there, you know, even if you go to, let's talk for a second, not about the grocery space, but even, let's say, outlet stores, you already see traffic levels starting to increase there. I see some articles that cross our Twitter feed that talk about how excited customers are at getting back into physical stores and walking around, even if it means maybe they don't have the money and discretionary spending levels that they did prior to March of 2020. They're still excited to get out and see what's new and really try to enjoy those in-store experiences. And I think as far as everything else is concerned, Trent, again, I haven't visited any new retailers, but I think there is a sense of optimism that surrounds the industry. And I think that's important for us. And it's important for our listeners that are business owners, small business owners that own small retail shops. I think overall consumer sentiment is up as well. I saw a report out saying that sentiment was up month over month. And I think that's, it definitely feels like that's the case as we head into these summer months. People are going to be itching to get outside, especially those that have maybe been vaccinated and just feel more confident with going outside and leaving their home. So I am curious to see what that does. And overall, curious to see as well if full service restaurants are able to return. I know that's something we don't talk about on this podcast, but me personally, I love to go out to eat. And it is interesting. Some parts of the country were shut down for longer than others, of course, but to see maybe the long-term ill effects of the shutdown for some of those full service restaurants and maybe some of the restaurants, the QSRs, for instance, that were able to stay open, to see if that actually negatively affects them now that people are perusing their different options that are now open, like full service restaurants, or like I said, maybe habits have changed to where people are cooking at home. So very curious to see how the entire dynamic plays out. And I don't know necessarily if I answered your question, Trent, but I know for a fact, while I haven't been traveling, I know you've been traveling. And in fact, one of the states you were most recently in was Montana and North Carolina. Correct me if I'm mistaken, but you had some good retail experiences in those areas.
Yeah, we'll start with North Carolina and Tennessee first. So I was in the Smoky Mountains region and also the Blue Ridge Mountains region, partially for retail and retail real estate, and partially for hiking and leisure, if you will. Now, the Asheville area is rather unique in terms of retail, but as was mentioned by one of our followers actually on Instagram, as I was posting some pictures there with Ingles and Food City and a number of other entrants into the grocery space is really crowded there. You've got Lidl starting to move in. You've got Publix starting to move north. Publix now with a presence in some areas near Gatlinburg, Tennessee, for example. And I think it's going to be interesting to see how the grocery space shakes out. I know Asheville, North Carolina, when you mention that, you think retail in Asheville, you think Ingles Markets. And I actually reached out to Leah McGrath, friend of the podcast, but also dietitian, head dietitian at Ingles Markets before I went out, just saying, hey, what should I see? That type of thing. But I went to probably 5-6 Ingles stores while I was there. Got a chance to talk to the Ingles store manager in Brevard, North Carolina, which is just south of Asheville. And it was so apparent how much pride he and the rest of his employees took in the store. Every Ingles store I went to was clean. It was merchandised well. Everything was faced well. The employees seemed genuinely happy to be there, which you don't always get in a retail setting. And I was talking to this store manager. He mentioned, you know, hey, I like to come out to Colorado every now and again too. So we had some commonalities there. But he, while I was talking to him, I had probably a 10-minute conversation with him. He was breaking down boxes. He was stocking. He was setting a great example for those around him, and he really had a great Ingles store to be proud of. So Ingles really dominating the market in Asheville. When you move west to Knoxville in the Smoky Mountains region, there you see a little bit more fracturing. Ingles has a few stores in Knoxville, but also, as I mentioned, you've got Publix, you've got Food City, you've got Walmart, got a lot of other players there, and that's not even including the natural foods, the Whole Foods, and so forth. So I think it's going to be interesting to see who's going to be the winner and loser when we look back 10 or 20 years from now. I think in my opinion, at least in the Knoxville market, I wasn't all that impressed with the Food City stores that I went to. I know obviously they've got a big, big presence in that general area, especially up near Bristol, Tennessee, and or Virginia, depending on which side of the state border you're on. But again, just in terms of grocery and that type of thing in Knoxville, you've got to think that something has got to give, especially when you've got other markets of the U.S. where you basically have Albertsons or an Albertsons affiliate, a Kroger affiliate, and Walmart and Target, and that's pretty much it. Now, as far as Montana is concerned, same thing there, only instead of local or regional chains, a lot of independent grocers you saw. Missoula has their own kind of Missoula Fresh Foods brand that has three or four stores in that area. But as you go through the small towns south of Missoula, so Hamilton and Lolo, there's a bunch of IGAs, a bunch of independent operators. Hamilton in and of itself has an Albertsons, a Safeway, and a number of independent grocers. And for a town that has a population of not even 5,000, you wonder how they can support all of those grocers. But I can tell you from experience, the one thing they can support is a Kmart. And in fact, they're really one of only two non-coastal Kmarts that are remaining, one of two of the 15 remaining. And I got a chance to talk with Brenda, who's in HR there. I got a chance to talk with Mark, who's also the lead of their data team at that Kmart. If you visit our Instagram, you'll see pictures of it. Has not been updated, the outside of the building at least. It's been painted and the like, but the logo hasn't been updated since the 80s. It was never updated to a big K or anything like that. And what's interesting about this store is historically, they were a top 50 store in Kmart's system. Even when they started expanding those stores in the 90s to super Kmarts and big Kmarts offering more grocery, Hamilton stayed in the top 50. Their sales aren't what they used to be, but still very good in comparison to the other Kmarts around. And this much was evident by the number of customers there. Basically, they just put everything they receive in terms of stock on the shelves. They estimated anywhere between 30 and 50% of their stock actually comes from third-party suppliers. They don't get Kmart trucks anymore. Rather, they get it delivered by LPL or third-party delivery companies like UPS, in fact. And anytime they get a truck, it goes out on the shelf. So there was not a lot of unused square footage. It was about 22,000 square feet is what Mark told me, and that's about what it looked like to me, about the size of an Alco or a Gibson's, if you were familiar with those. And I think it was just so interesting. It was like stepping back in time. They did mention they don't always get everything they need from corporate. That's understandable, certainly. But you talk about a retail staff. I met with probably 8 of them on the day I was there. Just a bunch of retail fighters to the core. They just want to see their store staying open. And the general consensus was, we want to be the last one standing, period. And that was their goal, is, hey, we're going to keep killing it here in Hamilton. We're going to keep rocking it. Whatever happens to the other Kmarts happens, but they go through third-party companies, as you would if you were a convenience store or something along those lines, to get merchandise. Now, all of that said, I think a big reason for that Kmart success is the fact that there is no dollar store penetration whatsoever in that area of the country. There's a dollar store in Darby, and there's a couple of Dollar Trees in Missoula, but there's not a Family Dollar and Dollar Tree in every town that you come across like there is in other areas of the country. And I found that extraordinarily interesting as well. So like I said, a couple of very unique retail environments, but also have commonalities. North Carolina and Tennessee, again, you have a grocery market where there's a lot of players in the space. Same exact thing in the Missoula, Montana area. Also, another thing I can tell you between both areas, beautiful hiking in both areas, and I highly recommend them to any of our listeners who might be into that type of thing. Well, let's go ahead right into our looking ahead segment. Our listeners probably tired of hearing us talk about traveling, and I've got a flight to catch to Fresno in about 30 minutes. So let's talk about stories that we're keeping an eye on for the next week, month, or year. Layton, we'll start with you.
Awesome. Thanks for having me start first, I guess. I presume you will have some retail stories about Fresno then, if you're traveling already again. But my story, my looking ahead story, has to do with CBRE, and this is a firm that is one of the biggest retail services firms in terms of real estate, so commercial real estate services firms in the nation. And Trent, I know you've interviewed several times people that work at the company talking about data analytics, and that's in the same vein here with this particular story. And it's actually something that is a common theme here that we have talked about previously, is the repositioning of malls throughout the United States. A lot of people talk about dying malls, B and C class malls throughout the US that were built between, let's say, 1960 and 1980, that are really struggling. Could be in pretty much any part of the country. It could be in a highly populated demographic, or it could be in a demographic, let's say, in Ohio, where you see populations drastically declining. But they're going to be, as a services firm, looking to help business owners that own these malls, own these larger malls, trying to really find the highest and best use. So they're trying to reposition and reimagine the traditional mall space using certain proprietary location intelligence technology. And I think this is interesting because they're going to be using more than just demographic information, Trent. They're going to be using all sorts of data surrounding logistics to see if maybe some of the spaces could be used for a warehouse. And we see that with Sears throughout the country being repositioned as short or long-term warehouse spaces. They're going to be looking at retail spending information. So a lot of different customer traffic patterns, and honestly, just the overall landscape of how a particular area that is surrounding a traditional mall that was built in 1970 has evolved over time. And maybe that the highest and best use is multiple uses. So oftentimes we talk about retail, but retail is next to other things. It's next to multifamily, it's next to hotels, office, healthcare. So their theory, their methodology going into this overarching project, Trent, is CBRE is looking at it as maybe these can be multi-use facilities. So maybe there could be a healthcare facility that used to be a Sears, let's say, and then maybe a defunct JCPenney could be a logistics center or something for life sciences. And if you see a quote from Mark Hunter, who's their managing director of mall and large format retail there at CBRE, he said that this data can help owners develop innovative strategies to support complementary uses to retail and create live, work, and play environments. And that really speaks to what I just said, in that they're looking at it in totality. What is needed in that particular area from the people who live and work in that area? What is of highest need? And if it just so happens to be multifamily, so be it. I was actually at a mall redevelopment here recently, Trent, in Northern California, where it was an old conventional mall built in the mid-70s, and it still actually had a Sears that was working that was not closed down yet, and there was a Macy's as well. But pretty much the entire interior corridors of the mall, all of them were vacant, and it was being transitioned to a mixed-use space with office, multifamily, and they were going to keep those two anchors, Sears and Macy's. So I found that development to be quite interesting. But this comes at a time, Trent, where their leaders have more experience than ever with these types of projects. They've been able to redevelop. CBRE has Class C and B malls into Class A malls. Hunter himself has over 30 years of experience working with some of the industry's largest mall investors. So I think that they're well suited to take on this initiative. And I'm very curious to see what projects in particular they're able to roll out and actually to create and tell the public, this is the value we're creating. This is an actual project that we've defined, we've strategized, and we've executed on in order to see something that was maybe at a 30% occupancy mall now transitioned into a mixed-use facility that's 100% occupied, fully performing, and oh, by the way, helps the community and may help with public nonprofits that needed space previously but were not able to do so because of zoning. Things of that nature. Really curious to see what they can do there. And I think this is really important too. The last thing I will say is oftentimes you look at the replacement value of some of these assets. The replacement value for a 1.1 million square foot mall is absurdly high. But some of these malls, these mall owners will file bankruptcy, and you'll see that there is actually a negative net present value for some of these malls because they're owing so much in terms of property taxes, property insurance, just general maintenance associated with the property, and yet they take in no income or very little income, which is more than offset by the expenses. So this is really, in my opinion, instead of tearing these beautiful malls down, this is probably the best option, especially if you can get into an area that is still well populated.
I was actually talking to a commercial real estate broker from Arizona a couple of months ago, and he mentioned to me that so many of these mall operators or larger REITs that hold the malls are just not simply paying the mortgage on that because the banks aren't going to foreclose on it because they know they can't sell the property for anything if they were to take it to the market. And they have more faith in these operators, the mall operators, to turn it around and maybe someday get mortgage checks from them as compared to selling it on the open market for a fraction of what it might actually be worth if it were turned around. So some interesting dynamics there in the mall space. I'll keep mine short and sweet. My looking ahead story is simple as what retailers are going to do surrounding hiring in the U.S. And this was actually a topic that came up in multiple places on my travels. Actually, most of all at Kmart. That Kmart in Hamilton, Montana, now currently hiring. They want staff, but they're having trouble finding staff. And it depends on who you ask as far as why this is. Now, the folks at that Kmart suggested that it might be those extended unemployment benefits. People are just staying at home rather than working because of that. And certainly the NGA, the National Grocers Association, thinks that's a part of it after they released a statement to Joe Biden earlier this week recommending that those extended unemployment benefits be rolled back because grocers are having a tough time finding staff. It's not always as simple as paying more, as I think you're seeing a lot of retail workers either get burnt out because of long hours because they can't hire enough people, or because, let's face it, I think most of us listening to this podcast, both of us on this podcast obviously have worked in retail. People sometimes aren't all that pleasant to work with. And so when you work with the public sometimes, you feel like there might have to be a somewhat of a premium in pay. Whatever the reason is, retailers are having a tough time finding employees and really scaling up. That's what I'm keeping a close eye on, because for the likes of the big players, Kroger, Walmart, Target, and so forth, Costco even, you've got to continue to find staff because you know the burnout rate in this industry is fairly high. You know the turnover is going to be high. Even for those companies that do such a great job, I mentioned Costco, they do such a great job attempting to take care of their employees. Still, the turnover can be high because retail isn't for everyone. So something I'm intrigued to hear a lot about on forthcoming earnings calls for retailers, especially some of the big ones I just mentioned. Well, that'll do it for us here on the podcast. A big thanks to Leighton for joining us this week. I'm Trent saying so long until next week, and have a great next 7 days.
Been the Retail Focus Podcast. For more, visit our website at retailfocuspodcast.com and subscribe on iTunes or Stitcher. Follow us on Twitter at Retail Podcast.